Welcome to the monastic community of Wat Pannanathat in the form of an anagarika, somebody who has left the household life, the home life, like you just chanted, and is now trying the monastic life in the community of Wat Pannanathat, taking on the 8 precepts as a formal adhitana, like as a formal vow in front of the Sangha. And we all wish you all the best, and that the taking on the anagarika precepts will lead you to peace and happiness, and to continuing possibly with the Samanera precepts and the Bhikkhu precepts according to the usual time frame that we go through the training here. Yet it is still a phase of for you to find out how you can deal with all the form and all the duties and all the, say, setting of the monastery, which you know a little bit already. I'm coming as a guest, but now, like, I'm taking it on more or less in a dedicated, committed way. It sometimes feels different, and also sometimes there are more duties, or there's more like expectations, or there's more ways of doing things that you gradually get to know. And we'd like you to experience these with an open heart continually, and try to say live with this say new form in a way that you can feel comfortable and at ease, and be able to say use it for your practice of letting go of defilements, and practice of overcoming suffering, dukkha, as we say in our monastic language or in Pali. So it's a form of commitment, and a form of like a dedication of one's effort to a specific convention. And in many ways this is similar to the principle that the Samaneras and the Bhikkhus use. We generally do understand that sila or wholesome karmic actions, entirely they are based on the intention of our actions. Say, whatever you do with good intention will give you good karmic results, and whatever you do with a, say, neutral, non-interested intention or no intention won't lead to any particular karmic results. And whatever you do with karmic intention that's unwholesome, an intention that's unwholesome will lead to the unwholesome fruits of your action. So basically the law of karma exists, and the practice that leads to peace and happiness is already apparent in the world, whether one takes a precept or not, like whether one commits oneself to this particular form or not. You'll always be responsible for your actions, and it will always have an effect on your mind, how you conduct yourself, and the purity of your own, say, inner heart in combination with all the outward actions will always be a very relevant factor for any being in the world. And I think that's very important to realize. The role of the form in the monastery is not like the ultimate truth in itself. It doesn't like do the job for you in that sense. Like it's not through taking on the anagarika precepts and becoming a pakao, or becoming upgraded to the status of a novice, or after a year or two, like upgraded to the state of a bhikkhu, will do any job for you, really. Like it's just mere conventions, and it can possibly actually be kind of even deluding when people get attached to externals, and forget that these externals are just like conventions, and they're not like the truth in itself. So it's very important to keep that in mind, and always put your heart into things. That's a very nice expression. Say, always be, say, with your whole heart, wholeheartedly, say, with your actions of body and speech, and always fill them with your whole aspiration towards like wholesome things, like and the wholesome things, like in our quest of of becoming an anagarika, or becoming a monastic, the very, very utmost wholesome say intention that we have is to attain freedom from suffering and to be able to break free from all karma, like, and all the implications of the law of karma that it has on our life as beings in this world. Say, karma and the conventions, the ways of good and evil in this world, they'll always be chasing each other. There'll always be some kind of process going on. There'll always be some unrest and some agitation and some intentions coming up from one side that need to be kind of looked after and pleased, and then some intentions coming from the other side. And they sometimes really meet in our consciousness, and they make the whole, say, complexity of the world almost unbearable for people. You feel like this is really, say, so complex how good and evil works in this world, and how good and evil manifests itself, even just from my perspective. How will we be able to have hundreds of millions and thousands of millions of people in the world ever come to peace with such a complex situation? You can simply look at some of the processes you observe in the forest, for example, a snake eating a frog, and you'd be kind of thinking, got to do something now, that this frog is being killed, and the frog is the innocent one, and the snake is the bad guy that eats the frog. Or so sometimes we just take a bamboo and hit the snake and chase away the frog or so. And we're pretty much partial. The poor snake doesn't get his meal on that day. Because of course we want to save the life of the frog, but what about the snake? If she doesn't eat any frogs anymore, it'll also die. Just looking at these processes, you can develop a mind that almost bursts with the conundrum or the paradoxy of how life, like in this like setting here, kind of is contradictory to each other and makes lots of unsolvable processes to keep perpetuating, and there's a constant chase of beings after each other. And in some way the monks or monastics here aren't excluded from that. Like, we're living a life that is highly supported by other people, constantly putting in sacrifices, constantly doing things that are actually difficult to do, or actually even somehow dangerous for them. Say, for example, coming here and say cooking a meal. You can imagine how many beings on this earth have to be sacrificed for us simply gratifying our hunger. Say, even if you're vegetarian, just think of all the insects that had to go. Or you bite into an apple, how can it be that this apple is without worms, that you're eating it, a cherry, without maggots? How can it be? It's only because somebody else is taking care somewhere and facilitates it, and makes it's kind of prejudiced for you to be able to have this meal, and gives, in a little comic, say, special bonus to you. Just like we, when we see the snake and the frog, we would say, snake, you've got to have a nice meal. We're kind of partial for you now. And so similarly, they say you anagarikas and you samaneras, because you've got to have a nice meal, got to be partial for you. We'll take this on and support you, that you can kind of just swallow it without thinking much. So if you think about the complexity of samsara and the cruelness of samsara and the your personal role in that, of being somehow like always in the center of everything, and always everything is tailor-sized and kind of like supportive for yourself and for yourself in the position, either through taking it by yourself as you do in lay life, or being supported by others in monastic life, it's kind of really dukkha, it's still insufficient. Like, we're actually taking some privileges here, we're taking some special, say, opportunity. So this is important to remember why we take this on and why we feel happy and comfortable with this, say, borrowing of special favors for us. It's because of our utterly wholesome highest intention of trying to leave it all behind and trying to go beyond the law of karma and trying to practice in a way that transcends and goes out of samsara, rather than, say, taking advantage of samsara. We question the whole thing and find it unsatisfactory and always lacking, and think there must be some way to end this process. And this is the ultimate highest intention that we can have as Buddhists, to overcome samsara and overcome all these compromises, these biased little privileges that we have wherever we are in this world, whether we're lay people that bluntly exploit it to their own personal egotistical means, or whether we kind of wiggle around a bit and do it somehow in a generous and say correct, politically correct way somehow, like it's the better part of society, or whether we actually eventually take on a certain conventional form that gives us all the, say, privileges that you'd otherwise have to work hard for and struggle hard for, so that we can actually, say, relax a bit. And then relaxing in this way, we have to be very, very careful that we're not just relaxing in order to give way to the pleasure of being on a holiday from samsara, but to remember that this holiday that we have here, this island, this special protected and supported lifestyle, is actually here for a very, very tough purpose. It's not like just a holiday of sensual pleasures where you have a nice little kuti and a beautiful, you say, kind of like natural setting, you say, eco-tourists would love that somehow. But like, you go one step further and say, we're actually using this as a tool, using this in order to end all suffering, end all these conflicts that come up in a human being, and somebody who has got a mind that sees these conflicts, you're actually working on it and using this tool, these requisites, these supports that people give us for ending the processes that are unpeaceful, unstable and constantly conflicting. So it's worth like just to clarify for ourselves, like we're not just to kind of hiding away and finding a comfortable niche in the form here, but like we're actually working on something. And the work in many ways is like the work of some skilled craftsman who uses certain tools and certain techniques and certain procedures of experience of how to come to a finished product eventually. And what we're doing now, we're receiving another set of procedures, instructions, a new manual or like a new set of tools that will help us accomplish this craft that we're crafting, which is our ultimate intention of getting out of samsara. And the good thing is that with all our knowledge about Buddhism or the Buddha himself or the Savakas, the enlightened beings that followed the Buddha, we can say, yes, that this tool has been working for quite a few centuries for people who apply it properly. That's why we kind of treasure this tool. It's not just something that we just try out and we use and throw away and then take another one or so, but it's more or less something that has been used for centuries in a way that is also well documented and well traded down from generation to generation. It's the tool of using the monastic form, which actually, you know, like it's not something that you are just now taking on now, but it's something that all the way back to the time of the Buddha and the Bodhisattva himself have been taken on. Many beings have been taken on, and in order to transcend samsara. And the good news is, by all the accounts of human beings that are traded down, there's quite a strong empirical basis on saying, yeah, it does actually work. It's not so easy though. Like, it's also a lot of, say, experience around the warnings in the manual and the special tricks that you need. So it's also quite filling up pages of at least the Vinaya textbooks, where you can see, oh, that was quite a shortcoming and that was quite a big miss. But also there's the side of, you know, the countless beings that have already kind of finished the work. So the finished quest of escaping from samsara. You can read the life and times of the Savakas in many accounts. One of the very inspiring little booklets of our scriptures is the Theragata and Therigata, where the enlightened monks and nuns at the time of the Buddha were writing down their special experiences in little poems. One of our monks, like Ajahn Chanchatamalo, he actually just came across it and going through the our Dhamma archive, he actually added some similarly styled poems of how he imagines the present-day Savakas, like the Kruba Ajahns, as we call them, would have expressed their experience in the same genre of poetry. And it's fiction, like he made these up, but like it's still interesting to think, actually, you know, what we read as a part of our holy scriptures, what is way in the past, is still kind of happening and still around. Like in Theravada Buddhism, there are people that do use the tools of the form of the conventions that we have guarded over many centuries. In its original purpose, like as a tool for liberation. It's very important to see that already the step of Anagarika is actually providing you with the full set of parameters that are needed to break out of samsara. And there is accounts of even pakaus and lay people or upasikas for the opposite gender that presently cannot take on the bhikkhu form, that even the Anagarikas that took on the 8 precepts, presently that there's people that have made the step out of samsara with using this form. And so it's important to see why this is, because, you know, the form itself doesn't do it, and the conventions itself, they're just the tools, just a particular power tool that you get as a worker or a craftsman. And the main way of looking at it is like to see the interaction, how the form works towards your heart, towards your, say, wholesome intentions in pursuing this very otherworldly aim. And the one point that comes to my mind, of course, is, you know, the renunciation aspect of the Anagarika precepts. It's very different than the 5 precepts, where there's no talk about, say, really renouncing sensual pleasures, renouncing the worldly attachments to things. There's just a short instruction of skillfully using them. Say, for example, if you have partnerships, then do them one by one. That's like the 3rd precept for people out in the world. More or less a little guide of not to get yourself too much into trouble, or not to spend your life paying off too much of the special privileges that you take. Whereas like the Anagarika form, or the form of taking on the 8 precepts, goes this step beyond the, say, basic regulations of non-conflict, but it takes on the concept of renunciation, of leaving behind certain parts of the privileges you could have in samsara for the sake of overcoming it. And a huge area that is pretty unknown to people out in the world, how much toll it actually costs, like, to run on this kind of like sensual pleasures lane. It's pretty much unknown, and we gradually study how the impact of sensual pleasures works and on our mind, and we study how it makes the mind much more happy and peaceful if we renounce some of these pleasures. Say, for example, like how we take on the form of simplifying the life and taking on the Anagarika precepts in this kind of slightly ascetic or renunciant tradition called the Thai forest tradition, where we kind of like go back to some basic processes and don't have too much embellishments and don't have too much stimulus. We don't have too much of a real holiday here. We've got a kind of work contract rather than a holiday. So we don't, for example, have ice cream and pizza in the evening, and which is like not intrinsically bad, but it reflects the principle of those people that have ice cream and pizza in the evening. They're actually karmically indebted much more to all these very horrific processes taking on of eating and being eaten in the world than we do. We just have it as minimal as we can. We kind of have our footprint, the kind of the karmic footprint, not the carbon footprint, the karmic footprint on samsara, as minimal as we can. So just cutting down our indulgences, the, say kind of like luxury, like we take away the part that's luxury and live with the essentials. Say for example, we eat one meal a day and use this as a feeling of freedom, freedom from karmic debts. We're not just constantly taking extras, but we're trying to be frugal, we're trying to say be careful. Say for example, this snake eating a frog, if it was a smart snake, it wouldn't overeat, it just eats one frog and doesn't constantly jump at any frog. Say if it's eaten, then it just goes to sleep for a while and doesn't kill frogs just for the fun of it. So there's even almost a natural principle that animals have developed, is that of satiation, that feeling of like, okay, I've had enough now, I'll just do other things now. Whereas like for a human being, somehow it's got out of hand, like we have got this very egotistical perspective where we feel like we can never have enough. And it's even supported by society, it's called like economy, and it's like just kind of to constantly stimulate your consumerist behavior, even though you've actually had enough, you take more, and the more the better. So I don't want to get too much into it, because that's exactly the point where all of us were kind of fed up with samsara, seeing the excessive indulgence and over taking advantage overly of worldly life. So actually we're really happy about finding a renunciant form where we can say, okay, for us actually this is enough. This is the bare minimum already, and we can live with that happily. And we feed on the good energy it creates, that we're actually not overstepping any rights. In fact, we're renouncing rights, we're renouncing a sense of entitlement to things that are luxury or overly kind of karmically, say, that have an overly big karmic footprint. So in this sense, the form does help quite a lot, at least to stay away from unnecessary trouble. Just think of all the trouble you could have leading a family life with wife and kids, with the struggle of survival multiplied at least by two if you have a partnership, and then by three, four, five, six, or however kids you want to have. How complex it is, and how people start getting into even unethical livelihood just for their family. They justify sometimes even very, very cruel professions just for having to earn their living in order to feed their kids. It's like the snake catching a few extra frogs for the snake babies. I don't know, it actually works like that. But like that's what human beings do excessively. They kind of create a huge crowd of relatives and start being protective, overly guarding to their own species, to their own family, to their own kids, to their own nationals, and to their own beliefs, and then start making warfare with others. So really thinking about it, samsara and karmic involvement is just really unsatisfactory, and really in the long run can only lead to more dukkha. So taking on these renunciant principles and the idea of less is more, only do the minimal amount of impingement on the life of other people, is a huge gain already for us. And it's sometimes just thinking about this, what have I left behind, and how beautiful it is that I can live without these very, very coarse forms of taking advantage of myself and others, or taking myself too privileged, and as opposed to others. This can already give you a sense of freedom and a sense of happiness about this path that you're taking. And it can express itself in many, many, many areas that you notice how the peace that arises from the idea, yes, I can renounce, yes, I can step back, yes, I can do with little, yes, I can live more simply, and yes, I can be peaceful. How these little reflections of our ultimate goal, how they nourish us with the right energy that eventually will bring us to leave behind the whole process of samsara. To see this in the actions that we do in the monastery, and the wholesome actions that are not only wholesome relatively, but they're wholesome in this way, that they're aiming at the end of samsara. Lhapa Cha many times uses this expression, there's the kamma that ends kamma. So in one way we're taking on another level of sila with the monastic training rules that actually in the world isn't really there. Like, I mean, within the five precepts it's not there, and the way people practice around Buddhism in the lay world many times also doesn't have that notion of let me do this kamma in order to end all kamma, let me kind of embark on this trip out of samsara. Sometimes it can be used actually quite opposite, like you can have like these people in the Dhamma scene and kind of eat and drink as much as they like and feel super happy, peaceful, but actually just full of themselves quite a bit, you know. It's kind of, actually in the monastery we don't meet these people, we only meet the ones that have had a taste of renunciant life. These are the ones that survive coming into the monastery gate. These are the ones that see actually, you know, the whole process of taking privileges, taking some sweet bread here and there is not fulfilling. You have this very a club of privileged people that see the danger in samsara and try to work on it. And that's why we're only so few, because most of the people can't really do it. Like, it's very difficult just simply to be able to sleep alone in the forest in this basic 3x3 meter wooden shack. We get this very basic training where you have to live on the bare necessities. So keep in mind why you're doing this, and why you're, say, not having a second meal, and why you're not having second looks at women, why you're not singing and strumming your guitar or composing love songs anymore. It's just more or less because this very, very deep feeling, oh, it's never going to end. And now at least I've got some tool that maybe I can actually end all these processes and stop making karmic footprints in this world. So the eight precepts, usually I've heard it before, but it's an important thing to remember. The eight precepts are very different than the five precepts. The five precepts are more or less very, very basic things that everybody has to actually observe in order not to go down in samsara, whereas the eight precepts are the ones that take you out of samsara or take you up. So we use all these little ascetic factors that come in with the eight precepts, like in that sense that you're working on renunciation. And the renunciant principles are very much expressed in what we call a bit old-fashioned in the celibate life. And a celibate life means a life that is not supporting sensual or sexual stimulus and sees the danger of it and keeps away from indulging in sexual or sensual pleasures. It's the main thing. You can say it's more or less the life of somebody who really sees the danger of samsara. Like, as you know, the phrase seeing the danger in samsara is actually one of the translations of the word bhikkhu that Lhapa Cha used to favor towards the other one, which is the one that asks for things, the beggar, bhukkha. So to keep this very alive in how you deal with the monastic form and with the precepts. So it's very difficult if you live in a too comfortable kuti with a too comfortable bed and too many blankets, too many pillows, to have that sense of applying effort or working on renunciation, which is really what we want to do. We want to work on ourselves, breaking out of samsara, and take any privileges, any luxury only as a very, very careful loan, so we can reduce our karmic footprint in this world, that we don't have to kind of constantly pay back the the depths of our indulgence, and we affirm our intention that it's really worth it to break free from the round of this perpetual dukkha through our wholehearted intention and putting our hearts into the form. The form itself doesn't do the job, but it's our own motivation behind it that makes it really worthwhile. And we're very happy that the two of you are taking the first step to practice together with us, and we'd like to welcome you in the group of our monastics, of those who've seen the danger in samsara and are working hard to get out of it, and may it all work out for each and everyone in this monastery sooner or later through the mutual support and reaffirmation of using these tricks and these tools and these forms correctly, and in a way that it'll end suffering in no long time, hopefully, bit by bit and in the long run. Anumottananda Sangha will now give their blessing to your taking on the Anagarika homeless life and taking on the precepts in a formal way.